This is Andre from Mental Health, and I'm here today with Rachel Rowan Olive, who I'm sure a lot of you will know from Twitter. She's an illustrator and a member of the Lived Experience Working Group that the Mental Health Policy Research Unit has recently set up. Do you want to tell us a bit about the kind of background to your talk and your kind of introduction to this? And, you know, why are you talking at this event, do you think?
Well, I guess my personal background is this is a diagnosis that I have and that I have a very complicated relationship with. I guess so 75% of people who get this diagnosis are women, and I think it's just not nice being told that your personality is disordered. It's just rude. Like, but also I think in the context of a diagnosis where 75% of the people diagnosed are women, you have to start thinking about, why is that? Where does that come from? Is that because there are things which happen to women which we respond to in ways which are interpreted as these symptoms? Or is that because actually there are things which everybody does, which in this context are pathologized in kind of the long and noble tradition that we have of pathologizing female emotion and female ways of being? And I think that's just a complicated question. And I think there's elements of both, probably, because bearing in mind that you only have to tick 5 out of 9 boxes to get this diagnosis, there's such a huge spectrum of different people who have it. It feels a little bit to me like a horoscope, like, you know, the way that they're phrased vaguely enough that it sort of looks like it's solid until you look closer, and then you realize, like, everybody can see a little bit of themselves in it, and then you look closer and it kind of evaporates. It feels a bit like that to me.
Yeah, absolutely. And you've spoken about your own kind of experience of services being relatively positive, although they're kind of studded with all sorts of horrendous discriminatory episodes as well. But I guess that's not typical, is it, of people with a diagnosis of borderline personality disorder? A lot of people don't get good support.
Yeah, I mean, I'm in a lot of ways incredibly lucky in that I actually have a care coordinator under a personality disorder team who I get on with and who supports me. But I don't think that is the case for the vast majority of people. I think for most people, it's a diagnosis of exclusion, even though, so there were two studies that were done about 20 years apart that looked at the predictions that clinicians made for someone who, like, they gave them a scenario that in one group they told them that this person had borderline personality disorder, and in another they didn't, and it was exactly the same scenario. The patient was described in exactly the same ways in every other way, and consistently clinicians made worse predictions and were more likely to make negative judgments about that patient if they were told that they had a personality disorder. And there's some evidence that there are particularly problematic attitudes among nursing staff. There was a review of literature done in 2015 that suggested that that was the case. And in the 20 years between those two studies, there were huge amounts of policy efforts to reduce this discrimination. And it kind of suggests they just haven't worked. So there was the No Longer Diagnosis of Exclusion document in 2003. There was Meeting the Challenge, Making a Difference in, I think, 2012, which was about supporting people with this diagnosis in the community. And then this repeat study showed that these attitudes are still there. Nothing's really changed. And that really makes me think, maybe this diagnosis is just irredeemable. Maybe there is no way to tell someone that their personality is wrong and not have the people treating them blame them for it. Like, I'm just not sure that it's possible anymore to destigmatize this. And I also think we talk a lot about stigma in mental health. It's become like the word that people use. But actually, this isn't stigma. This is more than that. Like, stigma is when someone doesn't like you because you're different. But when I told the crisis team I was suicidal and I couldn't keep myself safe overnight, and they went, okay, see you tomorrow. That's not stigma. That's neglect. Like, that's taking huge risks with my life. And I think we have to start being more real about what's actually happening if we're gonna fix this. Like, we can't pretend it's just people being a bit mean or like finding us challenging. It's like, it's more than that. It's people not doing their jobs because we have this diagnosis.
In terms of a diagnosis, do you think there's a better way of understanding these difficulties? As you said, it's a very broad range of experiences and difficulties, but do you think there's a clinically better way of organising it and diagnosing it?
I'm not sure that there's a single one. I think that for a lot of people, complex PTSD would be a better way of understanding this. But I think that there needs to be a lot of work done around how we understand trauma and how we understand complexity in order to not leave people behind in that shift. Because the way that complex PTSD is formulated in ICD-11, I think, is deeply problematic. It's very specific about what counts as trauma, and it's very specific about how the symptoms of or the manifestations of the difficulties that people have to relate quite directly to the things that have happened to them. And I don't think, like, that's not how complexity works. Like there's it says stuff like the kind of persistent feelings of shame and worthlessness relating to the traumatic event. And actually, memory of trauma is a very tricky thing and a very disputed thing. And if you've internalized a lot of shame and feelings of worthlessness, they're not necessarily going to feel related to a specific thing. Like, you're not going to think, oh, I feel worthless because this thing happened to me. You're just going to think, I feel worthless because I'm shit. And I think we need to reconsider how we think about cause and effect and how we, like, all the things that can intervene in that chain of events before we, like, I don't want people to suffer with the current system when they don't have to. But I think, particularly in the context of austerity, where services are so firmly gatekept, we need to be really careful that we don't start gatekeeping people's trauma experiences and policing them and making people, like, hold up the worst things that have ever happened to them to some stranger in a diagnosis interview and say, like, is this bad enough? Like, does this count? Is this a bad enough thing to have happened to me to justify how mad I am? Because I feel like that sometimes. And I think in some ways, the movement towards looking at adverse childhood experiences, I think that's a great starting point. But I think if we stop there, then that's what happens. We get this policing of trauma experiences that, like, these are the things that count as trauma and that justify you having mental health problems as an adult. And anything else that isn't on that list doesn't count. And what's missing from that list is often a lot of social factors, things like poverty, racism, homophobia. I feel like internalized homophobia was a massive contributing factor to me developing the problems that I have. Like, just nobody ever mentioned that women could fall in love with each other. Like, it just wasn't a thing. And so when I had feelings for other women, it was something that I was so deeply ashamed of. And I just didn't want to face it for such a long time. And I think that the way that things like that just slowly drip away like water on a rock at the feeling of who you are, and it just eats away at you. And it's not necessarily something that you can pin down to a traumatic event or a thing that happened. it's about the environment that you grew up in and the way that that invalidated your sense of who you, not just who you were, but who you could become. And yeah, so I think we have to be very careful around that. And I think we also have to think about things like traumatic events that happen also maybe when people are older. Like for me, one of the things that, like, so my dad died when I was 19, and that was a horrible thing, and it was a horrible process, and it was very isolating, and it happened a couple of years before I had my breakdown, but I think it was definitely a contributing factor. But at 19, I wasn't a child. Like, it wasn't a trauma that happened in my childhood. And I think, yeah, I just think we need to be careful about moving, just transferring everything about BPD across onto another diagnosis, because partly because not everybody's going to fit, and partly also because I think you can just end up with all the same prejudices just being switched across.
You know, over the last few years, we've seen this kind of real increased interest in trauma-informed care, and that started to have some impact in some places.
Yeah.
What do you think we need to sort of to do to change the way that professionals conceptualize some of these issues for people?
I think getting more service users and survivors routinely involved in teaching and training of professionals, I think, would potentially be quite helpful. But maybe that's just because I do that kind of teaching and training, and I would like to think that it makes a difference. Like, there's a certain element of maybe wishful thinking there. I think people need to be held accountable for their actions. And if somebody discriminates or neglects a patient, I think then if that patient raises that, they need to be taken seriously. And I think the way that the complaint system works, I don't think that happens at the moment. So I feel possibly a combination of more involvement in teaching and training, but also when that doesn't work, there being a robust system for holding people to account, which is never a very popular thing to say, because then people sort of sometimes interpret that as you kind of just wanting to hang people out to dry, and you kind of have to spend a lot of time validating that, you know, people are massively stressed and massively under-resourced and doing the best they can in a difficult system. And I do know that, but it's people's lives that people have control over, and if that isn't happening safely, there have, like, measures have to be taken to protect people.
So this event that's happening on Tuesday, the 22nd of January, is it's in London, and we're going to be live tweeting it and doing all sorts of audio and video stuff from the event. We're going to try and get people involved, particularly on Twitter, in the conversations. And it's a really kind of interesting program. You know, people with lived experience, people with clinical backgrounds, people with research backgrounds, people in policy roles, health economics roles. And there's talks, and there's also lots of kind of round table discussions in the room. What are you looking forward to most in terms of the topics that we're going to be talking about?
I guess I'm hoping and looking forward to kind of keeping a focus on pragmatics and on how we actually go about supporting people. Because I, like, there are parts in my talk that are quite theoretical and thinking about the construct of BPD, but I think we have to couple that with looking at, like, okay, what are we actually going to do? How are we actually going to change things? And I'm hopeful that in a policy context, having these discussions, that we can stay quite focused on that. Because at the end of the day, like, this is our lives in the meantime, and yeah, I love having discussions where we're like, imagine if we could do anything. But at the same time, then I kind of go home and I go back to my life in services, and that the disconnect between the discussions that I have sometimes and the reality is quite painful sometimes. So yeah, I guess I'm looking forward to trying to think about like what practically, how are we going to change things? How are we going to support people? What's happening already that's really good that can be built on from the ground up?
It's really positive, isn't it, that NHS England have got this on their radar, and it's part of the policy discussions that they're having, and the fact that the Policy Research Unit are doing this event and running this project. I suppose, you know, yeah, build on it and let's use this platform to actually have some real change. That would be fantastic.
That would be nice, yeah.
Just finally, I wanted to ask you, your talk is titled Feminist Critiques of Borderline Personality Disorder. What would you say is the most important take-home point for professionals, people that provide care?
That this is a gendered thing. There is no way of getting away from that. And everybody thinks they are unbiased, but nobody is immune to unconscious bias and to societal influences, and to just be open to the possibility that possibly society's views of women might be influencing your views of women that you work with and your practice, even no matter how much you are working with a view to wanting to help people and wanting to support people. Just so, I'm a Quaker, and there's a thing in one of the like Quaker testimonies that is, I don't know, like a Quaker catchphrase, and it's, think it possible that you might be mistaken. I like it because it's not like you're definitely wrong, all of the things you're doing are wrong, you're going into this with the wrong intentions, even though sometimes I think that. It's just like, just be open to the possibility that you might not be approaching this in entirely the right way. That's my take home. Think it possible that you might be mistaken.
Nice, that should be the hashtag for this event, shouldn't it?
I'm not proselytizing, I promise.
No, that's great, Rachel, brilliant. Thank you so much for talking to me. I'm really looking forward to the event on the 22nd and listening to your talk and reading your tweets. Thanks a lot.
Cool, thanks.